Now, what about human nature? Because our understandings of human nature and learning, the process of learning, is going to dictate how we go along. I believe there's something called the soul, that soul is a body, mind, spirit in unity. It's tripartite. It's like the Trinity. They're not separate pieces. They're all one, but there's three of them, body, mind, and spirit, all interrelated. That's the soul, if you will. Now, that soul has a whole lot of influences on it. There's the influence of genetics. You are influenced by your genes. You're influenced by those things that are inherent in your system. There's also the environment, your experiences. They try to influence you. Then there's two interior movements. There's God's spirit, and there's the spirit of evil. I believe that's true. They're both always trying to influence me. But you are, those interior influences are there, but you're not victim to those either. You're not victims to those either. So what happens is this body, mind, spirit has a sense of being free, of being free. It can go about its life and make its own decisions. It's why if you have three children, one's just like you, one's just the opposite, and the third you don't recognize. And why parents should never be blamed how their children turn out. You will only be blamed how you turn out, and that's more than enough to bear. We are born in the image of God, drawn to wholeness and health and well-being and the ability to be creative. And so we come together in community with that human nature. But we think of that human nature in three very distinctive ways. One way conservatives tend to like, one way liberals tend to like, and the third one neither one is accepted by. You can think in terms of people in terms of chronological age. So we speak of childhood, adolescence, adulthood, old age, and whatever. And we think in terms of the life cycle and the aging process. The metaphor for curriculum or the course to be run, if you take that understanding of human nature, is the learner is a piece of raw material, valuable piece of raw material. The teacher or the adult is a skilled technician. And the process of one is molding each piece of valuable raw material into the adult or teacher's predetermined design. We do things to children. Most conservatives like that one. And we set up our programs to do just that. Second one is developmental stage. We speak of humans in terms of stages in human development. It's called a maturation process. Of course, the lower is never as valuable as the higher. Nobody who's at stage five, and by the way, everybody wants to believe they are, thinks three is kind of low. It also identifies us with a cognitive stage, because all developmental thought is based upon cognition, or the age of reason. No other time in history would have ever developed. And it works against us because it puts people in these categories, and we are going to also now manipulate them to get there to the highest level. Now, the difference is the metaphor changes. The metaphor is now a greenhouse. The child is a seed. The teacher or parent is a gardener. And the process is caring for each individual seed until it grows up as it inherently is to do. But of course, the person who runs the garden always has a book on plants and their growth. Knows how much water to put on, how much fertilizer to add, how much to do it, so they can develop into a whole plant. Now we don't do things to people anymore, we do things for people. I discover most liberals like that one. There's the third possibility I would like to suggest to you, and that is seeing human beings as characteristics of life, to being human, to live in relationship. That we don't think about so much about events in our lives as process, bringing people together not by age or by developmental stage, but bringing together people by interest. By the way, if you do that, you'll have some intergenerational groups. Do something with drama, you're going to have everybody from a young kid to an old person there, because you need all for the play, and they'll come together by interest. You may end up with a group of all fifth grade girls, because they're the only ones interested in something or have that need, no problem. They're not there because they're fifth grade girls. They're there because they have that common need. And so you'll have some groups that'll be very intergenerational because it's very net, they all want to do it. And they will help each other to learn. Because now the method is a pilgrimage. The child is a pilgrim. All adults in their life are co-pilgrims. And the process is doing things with each other. The child has as much to offer the adult as the adult has to offer the child. They need each other. You want to get adults to do something with art, it's better if they're doing it for the kids' sake on the floor. But if you ask them to do it on their own, they'll be all panicked to death because they were told they couldn't draw. And so what you want to do is to bring them together in ways in which they can be with each other. They can share their stories. Children have stories too. Children can change stories, can write stories. How do we bring people together to be with each other? I want to take three words and show you how they changed during modernity and how we've got to recapture them in their original meaning if we're ever going to bring up ourselves and our children together in the life of the Christian faith. The first word is faith. Faith during this age of reason has become equal to believing. Believing that something is true. Faith has become propositional truths, which you are supposed to intellectually accept. That's how we have understood faith in the modern period. That's not how the church has understood faith through its history. Faith, rather, is best understood as perception. How we see, how we image, how we envision reality. The way we perceive reality is what is real to us. In fact, perception is not just perception. Perception is reality. How you see things is the way they are for you. And it makes a big difference how you see things. Many of us need to have our images of God healed. Because our image of God, our faith, is distorted. I think, for example, of a story from the Gospels. It's the parable of the talents. Now remember, a parable is always a subversive story. It's intended to subvert how you see things so you can see things through the eye of God. So if you read a parable and you're not uncomfortable, just realize you didn't get it and go back and try it again. It's a parable. It's a subversive tale. The talents. Remember, I'll summarize it quickly. One gets five, one gets three, one gets one. And they all go and the owner of the vineyard goes away. And that's God, by the way. And they all go do something with it. And God comes back. And says, what have you done with what I left you with? And the one says, well, I took it and I invested it and now it's buried. This is not a story about making money in the faith. In fact, just realize that what you have here is really one, is only one character in the story that's important. Any of you who write stories or write novels know that there's certain kinds of characters in a story which play a function. Their function is only to play up character who's the key character. And so it's really the third character in this story that's the only important one. The other ones are just to play off of. The third one says to God, God, I knew that you were a harsh, demanding, critical parent. And therefore I took what you gave me and I hid it to make sure it would be here when you came back. And now watch. By the way, in some of our translations there was a mistake made in punctuation. I'll put the right punctuation in for this. God says, you say, you imagine that I'm a harsh, critical, demanding parent? Well, I'm going to take that from you. I'm going to give it to them, and I'm going to cast you out where there's gnashing of teeth. Fun story, huh? God would never do anything like that. That's not the God of Jesus. Not at all. But that's the image of God that the third person had. And that's the only God that person will ever be able to know or identify with until somebody reveals to them another God. Because you see, we are the images that we create. Faith, not cognitive beliefs that we have to accept as true. But rather as a way of seeing the world. The opposite of faith is not doubt. In fact, without doubt, you cannot have faith. And without faith, you will always have doubt. The opposite of faith is not doubt, it's certainty. We have some in-laws who are confessed atheists, and we were visiting them and having supper, and the man insists upon telling us about his atheism, as if I were interested. And, of course, my wife ended up doing something. She's always more clever than I am. When he was all finished, she said, "Oh, you're a fundamentalist." That threw the party off. But she was right. You see, a fundamentalist can be an atheist or can be a believer. It's somebody who's certain they're right, which means somebody else is wrong. The opposite of faith is not doubt. Faith and doubt go together. The opposite of faith is certainty. Faith is a way of seeing. It holds that the world of the imagination is the key to all truth. How do we live with the imagination? So that in spite of all evidence to the contrary, we can see a God who is indeed at work in this world. There's no evidence to support it, except the eyes of the imagination. And for those with that imagination, they see God at work in every moment of their life. The second word is character. Now, by the way, prior to the 1950s, in what was once called religious education, by the way, we've never known what to call it, religious education, Christian education, church education, now we're into the new gimmick called formation. I can't find two people that can tell me exactly what it is and what it looks like, or whether they know they're doing it, but they're all in favor of it. Yeah? I unfortunately feel responsible for that because it was my idea. And they believed me. That was the big mistake. Don't ever write anything down. You can't say you didn't say it. In any case, character, now by the way, it was called character education then. Dewey, you go through all the great philosophers of education in the history of the United States, and you'll find in Canada, and you'll find those seeing as character education. Nurture was their word. My professorship at Duke was in theology and Christian nurture. I liked that better. I still prefer it better because nurture is a bigger word than formation. It includes two other words, which I'll end with tonight. In any case, character. Character is how we are disposed to behave. In other words, we're supposed to practice living in the reign of God, living in paradise. We're supposed to practice that. You have to have an image of what that looks like. What it looks like when the whole world is reconciled with itself, with each other. It already exists. That's what Easter was about. Paradise, the resurrection, the reign of God exists already. You cannot see it. It's not evident to just the eyes. It's in the eyes of the imagination, but I'm going to suggest to you it's true. And we're called to practice living as if it were true, because that's how we contribute to God doing something about making it true. You see, it's a twofold street. We, by nature, are totally dependent on God. God has chosen, notice the difference in language, God has chosen to be totally dependent on us. We can do nothing without God, God can do nothing without us. It's a with again. God with us, we with God. And so God already has created and brought into being God's rule. And we are called to live in it, to participate in it. And the last word is consciousness. Consciousness is important because we've spent a lot of time talking about having experiences in education. But the experience is not as worth nothing unless you reflect on it. And consciousness is the awareness that is necessary if you are to have the experience. In other words, why is it some people experience the Holy Spirit amongst them and other people don't? Well, the one has the consciousness to be able to see it, the other does not. But consciousness, you see, is shaped, is influenced primarily by the arts. There's a center in Oxford, England, on spirituality and the arts. They discovered through their research over a long number of years that children often under five had significant religious experiences. Then they asked why, where? Well, the first place was in nature. That could have been guessed. All religion was always danced before it was believed. The second one was with the arts, drama, music, dance, visual arts, and such. And again, the arts are basic for children. And the third was in ritual, repetitive symbolic actions. This experience of God was found for children as they participated in rituals. Many churches eliminated ritual for worship. The problem with that is that then people go someplace else for their rituals, because you can't, a human being is a ritual being. Tertullian, who was one of the early church fathers, had a lapidary phrase, "Christians are made, not born." That's a very radical idea. See, remember, you were a Jew because your mother was a Jew. You were a Muslim because your father was a Muslim. But within Christianity, having parents that were Christian was not going to make you a Christian. Christians are made, not born. The question was then how, and the answer was in Greek, catechesis. Catechesis means literally to echo. When the early church used it, they meant to echo the word with an uppercase W. The word, of course, was Jesus. So catechesis was to echo Jesus, to reproduce Jesus, to become Christ-like. In English, it became the word christening. Now, in the Anglican Church, christening became baptism, which saw it as an event rather than a process, which was lifelong. But catechesis was a lifelong process and not a single event. It's making Christ-like people so they could be indeed what baptism said they were, the body of Christ, Christ's presence in the world. And so we live in this need to learn to teach as Jesus taught. Now, most teachers in Jesus' day basically said, students would come to them and say, "Will you be my teacher?" And they say, "Sure, sit down." They sit down, they take notes and memorize them. It was the schooling instructional tradition. We all know that one because it's the one most of us grew up with. We were taught to repeat what the professor said, and that's what made it true. Hopefully you didn't do that. In any case, there are adjectives and there are nouns. If somebody asks you, "Are you a Christian?" It's very easy if you've been baptized. If you've been baptized, the answer is yes. But if they ask you, "Are you Christian?" Now you've got a problem on your hands. You might be forced to say, "Well, at noon, somewhat. By 4 o'clock, it got iffy. By 8 o'clock, not at all." Because we're talking about a way of life based upon a way of faith, a way of seeing life, understanding life, imaging life. It's a way of living. And so orthodoxy and orthopraxis have to go together. You can't have one and not the other. We're to teach as Jesus taught, because Jesus said, "Identify with me. Observe how I live and imitate me." That's what it means, and that's what we're called to do as the body of Christ, the church, is to live that out, to make Christians. But then we have to ask, what does a Christian look like? And unfortunately, I don't have time tonight to worry about that. But that is the question. What do Christians look like? And until you answer that question, you can stop all your programming, because you don't know what you're trying to do. You're trying to help bring into, how you're trying to influence. It may do a lot of crazy, interesting things and have a lot of people flocking to it, but you may not be making Christians. So what is it, then, to understand that? Now, this catechesis has three distinctive elements. There is formation, the new word, which I'll tell you what I think it means. Then there is education, which again has a different definition. And then there is instruction training. I'll start with that because that's the one we usually do in church. Instruction training is how do you acquire the knowledge and the skills that make it possible to live a Christian way of life. Most of us do instruction. Instruction passes on ideas. In other words, so we pass on the Bible. But the big issue is, which we rarely get around to doing, is interpretation. That's a talent. That's a skill. That's a technique. So it isn't enough just to know Bible, you have to know how to interpret it. It isn't enough to just know what is right and wrong, it's you have to know how to make moral decisions or discern God's will. You see, in other words, it's just not enough to know theology, you have to learn to think theologically. So there's knowledge and skills there. All of those can only be learned by adults. Yet what we've done is we've tried to take them into the Sunday school and teach them the children. And we failed entirely. What the children need is the formation side. They don't need instruction and training. You can't hurt them by doing it. You just won't do any good. So if you want to use your time that way, fine, go ahead. That does not mean I'm against Sunday schools. I was branded the enemy of the Sunday school for about 25 years. That's not true. I love the Sunday school. I just think it ought to be a different kind of place than it is. In any case, so in it you have this education is a simple, natural process. It's reflection on experience. You do something, you have an experience because you've done it. You reflect on it in the light, in this case, in the light of the Christian life of faith, and then you have learnings from that. And those learnings then become your new convictions, and you keep the circle going. It's a critical process. It's reflecting critically on your life day by day in order that you might become more faithful. That, again, is also an adult activity, but it's a very important one. Last is formation. I'm going to suggest to you that why I started working on formation is why I went back to get a doctorate at Columbia in anthropology. Because everything that anthropologists did under the word enculturation is what I was talking about catechesis. I figured maybe they've got some wisdom because we in the education community, religious education community, don't seem to have one. So I went to study how they do it. And if you go into the field as a cultural anthropologist, there's certain things you look for to understand why people see the world the way the world they do and live the way they do. I figured, okay, I'm going to take those and just use them. So if you want to talk about spiritual formation, then you talk about each of these categories in terms of an ever-deepening and loving relationship with God, which is the spiritual life. Or you can take it for something else, moral formation or whatever. And you can take it accordingly because it's practicing and participating in this Christian life of faith. The places you look are, first of all, ritual. Now, you have to face the fact that, right from the very beginning, that rituals are not something only the church has. The secular world has them, too, and sometimes they do a better job of it. If you watch the Kentucky Derby, you know what ritual is. Wish the church did as well. It's rituals for rich people. But it's ritual. Now, before you think I'm picking on rich people, spectator sports are the dominant secular ritual in our culture. Low Sunday is not the Sunday after Easter, it's Super Bowl Sunday. What we've done, you see, is the secular rituals that teach us violence, that teach us most of what we do, are in spectator sports. Now, I don't worry about the people that can't remember the score on Monday. I worry about the people in the Ulster Senior were number one. Now, they do their job very well, so much so that ritual has taken over, those rituals have taken over our understandings of the world. And we need to question that profusely, especially with our children. The environment, what people see, touch, taste, feel, and smell. I'd love to go to churches and look at bulletin boards. I can tell more about who you are by a bulletin board than anything you do. What do you encourage people to look at? What do you encourage them to see? What do you show them? What do you hear? What do they hear? All of those things of the environment play into their life. How do you order time? Calendars. Now, the church has a calendar of its own. It has a church year. How do we organize our life? How do we ask people to use their time, their talents? How do we ask them to use them? How do we make the tithe important? How do we realize that in the liturgy when we collect the tithes, we often call them alms basins. They were because that offering and the cash that went into it was to go for the poor. You might have a pledge, you might write a check for that and all that, but every week at the liturgy, you went and you put in at least a quarter into that plate as a symbolic action of the tithe, and that money was to go to the poor, not to support the institutional church. That's why we kept it on the altar during the Eucharistic prayer, because it was part of our offering of ourselves. What role models? Who are the role models? Well, you know who the secular role models are. People in certain professions. Who do we make our role models? It's why the church has celebrated the saints over time. Unfortunately, most of them were men and bishops. But we've begun to correct that and celebrate all holy women and holy men and their contribution to our common life. But who are the role models that we make up? Discipline, what do we practice? If you took children and taught them how to make resistance, it'd be the best gift you could ever give them. You know, sit by the television with them, and every time they see an ad, say, you know what they're trying to do? Sell you something you don't need. You do that for a little while, and eventually, like all kids will, they'll start doing it for you. And then you know you don't have to watch it anymore with them. They've learned how to resist. And so if you can teach people how to resist, they'll be able to do it. The other end is to teach critical reflection, not to just accept things because some authority figure tells you, but to think for yourself. Language, the language, of course, most of our language is the language of economics. I'll buy that. We're talking about ideas. Language is important, how we talk, how we say things. And last is how we interact with each other, how we treat each other. How we treat each other, honor each other, respect each other, the dignity of every human being. With those categories, you just take those and you apply them to anything you want to learn about this Christian way of life and how you indeed help to shape the lives of others and yourself at the same time is by participating in these together. Well, that's my reflections. Too much for tonight. Thank you. Too much for tonight. And so we're going to stop. Questions?
The contents of this podcast episode are reproduced by permission of the presenter and Woodlake Publishing under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations copyright. The Children, Youth, and a New Kind of Christianity podcasts are produced by Melvin Bray and Dave Sinis. The music for the 2012 CYNKC conference and podcasts is contributed by Brian Moyer Suderman. Stay tuned for more podcasts and resources for children, youth, and a new kind of Christianity on the World Wide Web at children-youth.com and woodlakebooks.com.
Can you imagine the world restored, earth and heavens too? Right at home with the one who says, I am making all things new. It's a new world coming and it's already here.